American Social History podcasts are a production of the American Social History Project, Center for Media and Learning at the City University of New York Graduate Center. Visit us online at ashp.cuny.edu. In part two of this podcast, Gregory Downs of City College of New York, CUNY, describes for New York City teachers how slaves built and strengthened communities through religion, family, and shared communication. This talk took place on December 4th, 2008, at the Graduate Center.
So part of it, let's start with faith. Now, the history of Christianity and slavery is a complicated one. One of the things that scholars have only recently discovered is that a great deal of number of slaves who were brought to the New World were actually Catholic and Muslim. That while a great deal of what used to be said was talked about this sort of breakdown of traditional African religious practices in the New World, then it turns out that as they look more carefully at where slavery was taking place, that both Portuguese missionaries and Arab Muslim missionaries had succeeded in converting a great number of slaves who were brought to the New World. And so this process of religious change was something that had been going on even before the Middle Passage. On the other hand, what we've become much more attuned to is the idea that there was a single set of African practices of religion has broken down as we looked at these incredible differences between different religious practices in parts of Africa. And so that what has become more and more apparent is that in making whatever syncretism, whatever sort of merging together of different practices in the New World, in doing that, that slaves could not rely upon a common set of ideas among slaves. This idea of a community of faith was not something that just happened or pre-existed. That arriving in the New World, many of them spoke different languages, that they could not understand each other. They had different sets of practices, and that they had to develop, make something in the New World that they could use to build up these connections. And so this process took a great deal of time. Different estimates, some people estimate that in the 1800s, in the early 1800s, how many slaves had been baptized in any way? Very hard to say. Some estimates, maybe only as many as 5 to 10%. By the Civil War, the estimate is somewhere between 30 to 40%. Now, does the fact of baptism, some people were probably baptized and didn't believe, there may have been people who believed and didn't. We can't really know for sure. But we do see the slow growth of an African-American Protestant, mostly Protestant, except in Louisiana and parts of South Carolina, Christianity, especially after 1800, as a wave of religious revival swept through the South, and then at these huge, enormously vast, 100,000 people, pre-amplification, people turning out at camp meetings, where both whites and African Americans are there being converted or being baptized at the same time. At the same time, some slave owners began in the 1800s to work to convert and to build up plantation churches as a way of social control. And many slaves make this difference when they talk about what the master's minister said. Be obedient, obey your master, servant, be a servant, be humiliated, be humble, worry about the afterlife, don't worry about this life. And the kinds of forms of experiences of Christianity that they had in these more secret meetings, these meetings in between plantations. And at those meetings, a preacher named William Robinson, who wrote After Slavery, talked about the ways that they would happen. He would say, in order to notify the slaves on other farms, when there's going to be a meeting, they would sing the song, and the slaves would understand what it meant. So they have to communicate, but they have to communicate in a way that doesn't give away too much. And you can see what a problem this poses, and also the ways that people find solutions to it. Singing, get you ready, there's a meeting here tonight. And if asked about it, they would say, oh, no, that's just a hymn. I'm just repeating, this thing you taught us. Then they would carry with them lamps with a greasy rag for a wick, and they would attach a sharp spike to the lamp so as to stick it in a tree. And this way they would light up the swamp while they held their meeting. Or M.L. Lotta, another slave minister, said, I remember we had these secret prayer meetings and prayed to be delivered from slavery. This way that an African-American Christianity, unlike the Christianity that they were getting in their master's churches, preached these levels of freedom and deliverance. And I remember I asked father and mother why they were hollering so loud about, and they said they were praying to God to deliver them from slavery. And that within this African-American Christianity, we see some things that are to a great deal in common with other forms of Southern religious experience. It tends to be more emotional, tends to be less structured, tends to be less ritual than Northern or Church of England Episcopalian Christianity. But some things that are clearly particular to the way the slaves are practicing it, an emphasis upon conversion, an emphasis upon heaven, and a dramatic decrease in an emphasis upon hell. When asked about it, slave preachers would say, if you're a slave, what do you need to be told about hell for? Right? They didn't need hell to teach them, you know, the ways of understanding the world, that slavery existed in this sense as a kind of hell. And also a set of parallels, of people making comparisons between themselves, and especially of the ancient Israelites, and of Moses leading the Israelites from slavery in Egypt into freedom. And this sort of constant use of this as a way of reminding themselves both of this capacity, of the righteousness of freedom, of the fact that people could be slaves and yet still be worthy of being free, and of this long-term historical capacity for deliverance. Now, there were ironies about resisting through faith, just as we'll see there are ironies about other forms of resistance. On the one hand, in making life tolerable, slaves carved out separate psychological and spiritual worlds for themselves that were distinct from their owners. And so they saw themselves as worthy and good. And yet at the same time, as Frederick Douglass and many other ex-slaves would write, this practice of an emphasis upon an afterlife, upon eventual deliverance, led some of them to question whether this practice of religious practice had undermined the capacity for violent or immediate actions to overthrow slavery. Whether or not it bred a sort of long-term, such a focus on long-term deliverance that it undermined immediate resistance. And this would be a debate that would go on within slave communities and that would go on long after slavery, of immediatism versus gradualism, of whether Christianity brought people together or whether it became a way of coercion or control. Another way that we see slavery forms of resistance is through family formation. Now, this is also something about which we know quite a bit, but huge gaps in knowledge. And a basic question that had emerged was, did families that were made in slavery stay together? But there were enormous pressures upon family formation within slavery. The most obvious was that husbands and wives could be sold off, the children could be sold from their parents, and so that this lack of, you know, separate from the strains that families face for all kinds of other reasons, there were these basic practical strains. And that during the Civil War, we'd see this sort of large discussion among Northerners of slaves don't know how to make family. They don't have to keep them together. It has to be, you know, something that's taught to them. As we look back, then we see these aspects that sort of help us to separate out the role of slavery in breaking up families versus what happened in families that did stay together, even with the strain. And so from one record of 1866, of marriage, so right after the end of slavery, of roughly 3,000 marriages, about 400 of them had stayed together, had been unbroken. On the other hand, as you start to look out, what broke them up? By master, meaning one had been sold away from the other, by death, or by the war itself. And so that once we sort of reconfigure the numbers into people who have the capacity to choose, some element of capacity to choose, that even with the ways that slavery and the war had put pressures upon marriages, that still a majority of marriages that could be kept together were kept together. Even taking into account that sometimes people did not have sometimes people were married off by their masters or didn't have, you know, the sort of capacity to choose their mates the ways that others did. And so thinking through things like this helped scholars get a much better sense of how to make sense of the priority or the emphasis upon family and the way that slaves talked about their life. That there were this capacity to keep together some families despite this enormous pressure. One of the things that made the pressure so intense was that as we get into the 19th century, we see an incredible shift in slavery that's often missed, but that played a huge role in breaking families apart, which is the growth of what's called the Southwest. Now, you're going to think I flunked geography because you're going to look at Alabama and say, that's the Southeast, that's not the Southwest. But in the context of the 1800s, Alabama, Mississippi, Texas were the far west. They had, many of them had not been parts of the United States at the founding. Many are brought in by Louisiana Purchase and some treaties with Native Americans and wars against Native Americans in the early 1800s. And in what scholars call the Second Middle Passage, about 1 million slaves are transported from Virginia between 1800 and 1860 from Virginia and South Carolina, Georgia, North Carolina, to these states of the Old South, the states of what was the Southwest. So an enormous upheaval and dislocation that it's easy to lose track of because of the, but that in some ways had as powerful effect upon slave worlds as the first Middle Passage to the United States. So 1 million people transported from this eastern seaboard into the Southwest. And an enormous number of those from people, you know, people who were of age, where they had families and children, and were sold downriver, which in many respects meant down the Ohio River, if you were in Kentucky or Tennessee, into the Mississippi, and sold into places like Louisiana and Texas, where someone in Virginia would never have access or even word from them. And so this has an enormous effect upon slave life, as well as an enormous effect upon the United States, that these eastern seaboards, the proportion of slaves drops, as tobacco gets less valuable, and as they burn up their land, that because they tended not to do crop rotation, that these old plantations get less and less profitable. But the expansion of cotton into the Southwest means not only an increase in slave population, but also this increase in the power of cotton, that the United States goes from being primarily slaves focused around sugar, rice, tobacco, to being primarily focused around cotton. And this really happens later in the 1800s. After 1800. And so this would have enormous impact upon the capacity to keep families together. And yet throughout it, we see this discussion not only of family formation and settlement, but also of the ways in which the difficulties of keeping families together becomes part of how they prove that families matter. That in this double way, that the harder slave owners worked to make it difficult to build up families, the more that they would attribute meaning and value to them. So that in the process of running across, of running to other plantations, that Georgia ex-slave Marshall Butler remembers being whipped upon going to see his girlfriend on a neighboring plantation. And he said, well, we knew it. It was worth being paddled. And that was why they liked us, because they knew that we cared enough about them to be worth being paddled to go over. And sure, we'd get whipped, but what would we do the next day? We'd go back, because it was worth it. But in this interesting way, the difficulty and the pain of it became inscribed upon the meaning that was made of it. We also see an enormous efforts in these narratives of this discussion of the enormous efforts of fathers. It tended to be that slave children were kept with their mothers. Many slave marriages were cross-plantation, were from neighboring plantations. And so these descriptions of the father's efforts to cross to find their children. And so Samuel Boulware remembered that his father lived 2 miles away. And he said, if they caught my father without a pass, he was sure in for a skin-cracking whipping. And he knew that, but he would come to see us anyway, whipping or not. Or Charles Ball, one of the most sensitive of slavery writers, would say, poor as the slave is, and dependent at all times upon the arbitrary will of his master, or yet more fickle caprice of the overseer, his children look up to him in his little cabin as their protector and their supporter. And that in this way, this sort of family reconstruction was able to work to sort of provide this counterweight to the notion of not people but property, and to reinscribe these personal relationships. And yet also at the same time, the sort of notion of a domestic family, of a sort of nuclear family, of husband, wife, you know, 2.5 children, was increasingly difficult to maintain as more and more slaves were sold to hundreds and even thousands of miles away. And so we also see the development within slave communities of what we call fictive kinship, of a kinship of a family that's made not by blood or by marriage, but of a practice of adopting uncles, of adopting cousins, of these family practices that are meant to say, if your uncles are sold away, then find a new uncle. It doesn't mean that these sellaways didn't have effect or didn't cause pain, but became these ways that people would find a spot for family formation, for complex family formation, family formation that extended into dozens or even hundreds of people in the midst of this. At the same time, this also posed an irony, and it reminds us of the ways these forms of resistance could also end up being tied to or even supporting the power of slavery. That as Frederick Douglass, William Wallace Brown, many slave writers pointed out, Harriet Jacobs, that having children at the one moment could be the moment of the greatest personhood of a slave, right? The sort of experience of parenthood, of power, of control, but of power, of dependence, of care. And at the other hand, of course, in having children, they were doing exactly what their slave masters wanted them to do, because those children became part of the capital assets of the masters. And this doubleness, this constant doubleness of meaning, that it was both a deliverance from and literally the reproduction of slavery, would haunt family relations or show us the capacity, the limits of it. At the same time, we see a final form of a type of resistance through association. Through these associations that are probably more what we think of when we think of the notion of community. And we tend to think of communities as made, not born, and made through space. And this was a big part of how slaves began to build up not just kin groups, not just churches, but also a sense of, you know, to put it in sort of modern terms, of we're all in this together. This seems obvious to us. But when you look at other cultures, that even cultures like Brazil that had massive slave uprisings, that they often, Brazil had a massive slave uprising of mostly Muslim slaves who rose up without branching out into, you know, without making connections or seeing an association between them and other poor and other slaves in Brazil at the same time. And so the process, it reminds us that even resistance can be expressed in all kinds of different ways. And that what happened in these efforts to make associations is what Friday Jones, a slave minister, would write later, was the process of teaching each other to love each other. Which is, I think, an interesting way of putting it. Because if we assume, looking back, well, of course slaves took care of each other because who else was going to do it? It also reminds us of the danger of it. So where, how could they build up associations? One way is by helping runaways. But if you're helping a runaway, then you're exposing yourself by communicating, by, you know, setting times for meetings, by talking about what they heard from the master. But at every moment, there was this awareness that by reaching out, they were also exposing themselves. And there are many, many examples of slaves being turned in for talking about something, for doing something, for saying something they shouldn't have, for helping a runaway, for, you know, taking some privilege they shouldn't have. And this complex formation of how do you learn to trust people whom you only know slightly or only know a little bit. That this dangerous lesson of how do you build up the sense of trust in community and how do you make it. One way is that it's made through these actual places and practices. Where do they go? And so just to give you a sense of how this works, is a sense of what is the breakdown of our image of what plantations were like. That this picture of Monticello, some of the particular landscape has changed over time, but gives you a sense of how powerful the woods are. One estimate is something like 80 to 90% of southern land had been, was these forms of former plantations and farms that had been overgrown, or swamps. And so when we think of the world of the slaves, on the one hand, we can think of it largely as through work, which clearly is at the center of slavery. On another hand, we can think of it through this community of cabins, of these worlds of slave cabins and slave neighborhoods set up behind, through chain gangs, through these meetings and parties. And yet, on the other hand, we can think of it as what takes place in the woods. What is it that's possible to be made in between plantations? And what is it that it allows them to assert communities that go beyond their individual family, their individual church, their individual plantation? And so these meetups in the woods have a spatial meaning, too. It means a sort of claiming of space, and a claiming that if the owners say you belong to the Robinsons or the Johnsons, that you're also to build up your own world in between. And these worlds could be for parties. They could be for pleasure, they could be for religious events, they could be for funerals, like you talked about. They could also be for running away. While an increasingly large number of slaves ran to the north, another thing that we don't take into account is that a large number of slaves who ran away didn't actually go to the north. They hid out. Why? Because they had these families, these communities. They didn't want to be slaves, but they didn't want to be apart from their families or communities either. So, what happened in these events? Well, people talked. They talked about politics. They talked about family. They talked about who had been whipped. They built up the sense of shared experience. It could be a shared experience of pain, a shared experience of pleasure, that then allowed them to say, what is it that slavery is and what is it that we have in common? At times, these forms of talking could erupt into large-scale rebellion, large-scale resistance. And these could be forms of resistance that went into unusual levels in an American context. And twice, two major examples of armed uprisings, most famously Nat Turner, but many other examples of gossip and whispers, of ideas of plans or talk about uprisings, plans or talk about freedom that would have meaning. At the same time, this notion that slaves were building up their own world posed problems for masters. So it not only allowed them, slaves, to recreate some notion of personhood for themselves, but it also changed the ways that masters behaved. That slavery became increasingly, over time, a system of supervision, surveillance, policing. That much of early American policing actually grows out of the slave patrols, including American terminology of policing, the beats, the patrols, grow out of a system set up in the South to make sure that slaves didn't do exactly this, that they stayed in their cabin, and to make sure that they didn't cross into this yonder world of the woods, whether for romance, parties, religion, whatever. And so we see this enormous setup of a police state within the South, what scholar John Will Franklin called the South as an armed society, an armed camp, a militant society, because it took more than just a master saying you can't do it to keep people from doing it. And so this enormous police state that gets set up in the South to keep people at home, not just so they don't run away to the North, but also so that they don't make these connections to each other. And so there we get an irony of the effect of the slaves, that the more of the slave owners, the more the slave owners work to say, you can't, we get the more that slaves say, it must mean something. In other words, this doubleness that goes on. That says, yes, we can.
Yes, we can.
This doubleness that goes on. That says, if they don't want us to do this, then it must be because somehow it's really having an effect. It's really striking at something central and core. And so this doubleness would also take place on the other side. The harder that slave owners work to keep slaves from coming together, the more that slaves in this classic inversion, where they would hear what their masters wanted and assume that the opposite must be true, gets played out so that it gets more and more important. And we see this in something like Louisa Davis, a woman who lived in Winsboro, South Carolina. And she was asked about the patrols and her husband coming to see her and the ways that it affected it. And she said, did he come to see me? She said, don't you think I was a good-looking woman? Didn't he want to see me more than the twice a week his owner would let him? Wouldn't he risk it without the pass? Of course he did. They came over and ran him many a time, and every time they did, he would come find his way back. But in this effort to deny meaning, created this sort of double way in which slaves inscribed the meaning in the ways that they did what they knew that their owners did not want them to do. Now this notion of how in the end do we make sense of all of these sort of conflicting impulses, these sort of dynamic, complicated relationship between what slave owners wanted and the world that slaves lived in, is something that continues to sort of pose this problem that I started with, which is the impossibility of fully imagining or easily understanding slavery or turning slavery into something that we can simply say it's ABC. On the other hand, it also poses these possibilities, which is the very way that slaves were able to make meaning and yet also to make meaning within a world not of their own making. It's something that scholars have used to talk about all kinds of different ways in which this is true, that even if none of us are slaves, that all of us are brought into a world of which the media, you know, which is determined not solely by us. And yet the sort of complex ways in which people make meaning in a world not of their own making. We also see ways that it proves to us that even as why it is that the events of the Civil War, which I know you'll talk about later in the year, transpired the way it did. Why it is that Union officers, as they came into the South, said immediately, even before the Union had said it was for emancipation, that slaves believed that they were there to emancipate them, even before the North knew it, that they were there for that reason. And that in believing it, as you know, you'll talk about later in the year, they made it so. And that part of it is because of these systems of meaning that have been established, not as naturally occurring events, but been established over decades during slavery. There are also ways in which it had meaning because of the ways that it helped to cause the Civil War. That this paranoia that it bred among Southern slave owners, that if there were only a couple times in American history where there were large-scale slave uprisings, there were hundreds, even thousands of times where slave owners thought they were in the midst of an uprising. And maybe they were right some of the time and caught it before it happened, and some of the time it seems like they invented it solely out of their own nightmares. Their fear of it structured it so much that it built a Southern society that was increasingly not only militant, but I, in some ways, on the verge of a breakdown. There's a sense of constantly feeling themselves under attack, even when they weren't, and it would help to propel the South out of the Union, in part because of this fear of what the slave owners were doing. So in the end, and there are many other ways in which we can talk about the effects of it, but to make sure that we have time to get to the reading that I brought and to your ideas about what it tells us about slaves. But to wrap up quickly, that in the end we come back to this notion that slavery is impossible to sum up. It's impossible to fully tell the history of slavery. And yet the process of getting into it leads us into this incredibly rich and fascinating vein of material, pictures of life, that even if we walk through the things I've said here and the readings we'll talk about in a minute, that we face a society in which people have significant limits and also find moments of partial freedom with it. And that even if with humility and a consciousness of the fact that we'll never be able to get it fully, it's worth doing, in part because of the richness and the sort of interest and the beauty of what's there, and in part because of the ways that it makes us sort of come back to this thing that it seems to me is at the heart of the social history project, which is how is it that people carve out moments of power, moments of individual leverage within worlds that are not of their own making.